This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Just minutes ago, Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley announced, quote, "In consultation with my command staff, I have asked the mayor to," this is a statement from both Chief Isaac and the mayor. So this is Chief Isaac saying, "In consultation with my command staff, I have asked the mayor to extend the curfew into tonight." So Tuesday night, beginning at 8 p.m., that will end Wednesday at 6 a.m., Mayor Cranley did grant that request. What Mayor Cranley said is, quote, "In the interest of public safety and the safety of our police, I'm granting the chief's request to extend the curfew into tonight. I commend our cops for all their hard work, and I appreciate those protesters who continue to behave peacefully." The curfew continuation follows more days of protests and unrest in downtown Cincinnati, and we're going to talk about that throughout the hour today. If you would like to join our conversation, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email your comments or questions to talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Joining me now live on the phone is Nick Swartzel. He is a reporter with Cincinnati City Beat, currently on furlough, but is out on the streets covering this story anyway. Nick, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nick, take us through what you saw last night, the most recent night of unrest in Cincinnati.
I think last night was different in that it ended a lot earlier due to the curfew being kind of pushed up to 8 p.m. There were still a pretty big presence of protesters at the courthouse. There was a separate march from Fountain Square to the courthouse that kind of converged, and then everybody moved up Main Street. Within 10 or 15 minutes after the curfew had ended, police presence got very heavy, and people either dispersed or were arrested. Chief Isaac at the scene, Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac, said they had arrested about 40 or 50 people. There might have been some more arrests after that, but it seemed like things, after the curfew started, things clamped down pretty quickly, and that was more or less the end of it.
We did see some arrests again last night, as we did over the weekend as well. Did it appear that there were fewer arrests last night when compared to the 100 or so each day on Saturday and Sunday?
I believe so. And again, I wasn't everywhere, but I think I saw one of the larger groups of arrests happen. They're kind of on McMicken and north of Finley Market area. And as Isaac said, about 40 or 50, which the night before I was just on the perimeter of a group of about 100 people that got arrested, and they were loading them into Metro buses. It was a much larger group that night, I think.
Did we see some Metro buses being utilized for moving detainees or arrestees last night as well?
Absolutely, yeah. There were a group that were kind of on the corner of Central Parkway and whatever street that is that connects it with McMicken. I don't know if it's Mohawk Place is the name of that street. And that group was loaded into a Metro bus. I think there might have been two Metro buses present. But, the night before it was like four at least, and other vehicles being used to arrest people. So, yeah, there were Metro buses last night, not as many.
And we're talking with Nick Swartzel, a furloughed reporter from Cincinnati City Beat. Nick, talk a little bit more about what's been going on completely in recent days. So we know there was activity last night. There's been activity every night for several days now. What is the sense that you're getting of this city that you cover so well and that you know so well? What are you getting out of this? What are you hearing the most? And what is your sense of the community right now?
Yeah, I am seeing a lot of peaceful protest, and I'm seeing some pretty large. I think the night before last was one of the biggest marches I've seen in the city. And one of the things I think is really interesting about it is that in the past, covering sort of the Sam DeBose reaction in 2015, there was a sort of core group of people that were putting those together. And I think they, shared credit for what they were doing. But it was pretty identifiable who the leaders of these marches and things were. And as they were experienced organizers. And this time around, I'm seeing a very diffuse organization, like lots of people involved, in no real one group that's leading it, and pretty young people in most cases, sort of maybe a new wave of young Cincinnatians who are organizing this. And with the help of some people, I wouldn't say they're out-of-town agitators. I think people who are organizers from Columbus or other places who are coming in to provide a little bit of support, mostly local, but a few of those too.
Nick, as I mentioned, you're currently furloughed from Cincinnati City Beat, where you do the bulk of your reporting, and many people can relate to your current situation with being furloughed themselves from whatever industry they're in, the media certainly being impacted by this COVID-19 pandemic that's happening on top of everything else that's going on in the world right now. You're out there on your own accord right now recording this, and I guess I'm wondering why.
That's a good question. I mean, because getting paid isn't why I do this. So getting paid is the thing that allows me to sustain myself while I do this. And I'm lucky enough, you know, I was saving to buy a house before all this started. So I have a little bit of a cushion, which is a rare thing for a journalist to have, I think, on our salaries. But I would be doing this if I could without pay all the time. And, you know, journalists deserve to get paid, obviously. But that's not why I do it. And it's almost a compulsion at this point. And I'm incredibly lucky that City Beat is continuing to exist. And I hope it continues to exist long in the future and provide me an outlet to publish the reporting that I'm doing. And, like I said, the payment is not secondary, but a little irrelevant to the drive to do it.
And while you're out there doing this on your own accord, and we are going to be talking about the danger that some journalists are facing in the middle of all this as well in just a few moments, but you took a photo, Nick, early on in these protests that, I mean, to call it viral is probably underselling it. This has become a key image of the way some people interpret the different attitudes that certain types of people might have about what's going on across the country. This thing is all over the place. Can you describe that photo for our listeners who may not have seen it yet or may have seen it, not knowing of its origin, and give us the appropriate context for it?
Absolutely. The photo was one of a number we ran in a slideshow about the first night of marches and protests and things like that. And it's a group of people sitting behind a sort of like orange barricade that they put out so people can eat and drink in the street during the pandemic. And they're sitting there and they seem really relaxed. They are looking kind of stylish, dressed up pretty nice for a night out. And behind them is a wave of protesters just going down the street. And some of the people in the sort of dining, you know, situation or drinking situation are not really paying much attention to them. Some are kind of looking off like they're kind of wondering what's happening. And then, you know, the protesters are kind of minding their own business too, going off on their own way. Maybe one or two are glancing over at the people sitting and drinking. And I took it because I thought it was an illustration of, this everyday life that is what is going on and over the Rhine right now. Juxtaposed with this urgent moment that we see all over the country, but, you know, here in Cincinnati especially. One piece of context that I think is really important to think about is this spot is very close to the place where Timothy Thomas was shot and killed by a Cincinnati police officer in 2001. I think also that Over the Rhine has become a symbol for some people of what some people call gentrification, displacement of lower-income people. I think all those things are wrapped up in that photo if you're local and you know that. The commentary on that is really complex, and I wasn't trying to get into that commentary with that photo. I was just presenting, here's what's happening right at this moment.
And we're talking with Nick Swartzel from Cincinnati City Beat. You saw some things last night involving some journalists, and I think you yourself were yanked around a little bit by police. And just so our audience knows, I think we as journalists are subscribing to the idea that we don't make ourselves part of the story. Sometimes you do get swept up in it. We know there are elements and people in our community who face serious dangers more frequently just by existing. But for the purpose of today's conversation, we are going to talk a little bit about the media's role in this. And you got some video of Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Pat Brennan being pulled to the ground by about half a dozen officers. And you took some video of it. I'm going to play a little bit of sound from that right now. Nick, what was going on there?
Yeah, so Pat and I had both, in the video you'll see there's a SWAT van, and we had gone around the other side of that SWAT van to try to get to the place where people were being arrested, because I think most journalists who are covering this would agree that it's part of your job to document the way police and protesters are interacting. And that's just a core part of accountability journalism for everybody involved. And that's what we were trying to do. And so we were told to back up and go around the other side of the van. And we were complying with that order from an officer. I was backing up away from the officer backward. I was pulled by another group of officers with shields and helmets by my bandana. I experienced a couple of seconds where I actually couldn't breathe when that happened. And that was like pretty shocking. And then I thought I was being arrested, but then they just kind of chucked me to the side. So at that point, I follow Pat around because he's trying to get to the other side. On the other side of the officers are some of Pat's colleagues who I think are motioning to him, or he's motioning to them like, hey, I'm coming to join you. And then that exchange that you heard takes place. And Pat is like adamant about like, hey, I want to go over there and report. I need to do my job. The officers are, you know, adamant like, no, you're not going to do that. And then the exchange happened, and Pat ends up on the ground with, I think, half a dozen officers on him. And he was arrested and taken over to the corner in handcuffs and, you know, kind of just sat on the curb with a bunch of other people who were arrested.
And we heard from a lot of city officials about that particular arrest. Goodness knows hundreds of people have been arrested here locally since these protests began. This particular detention, I don't know that he was arrested, but this detention of Inquirer reporter Pat Brennan caused a lot of commotion from city leaders. Can you tell us a little bit about the reaction from city leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for making the distinction between arrest and detention. I think that's important. I posted the video on Twitter just because when something that I think is significant happens, I try to just present it without comment, like here's what happened, you know. And I think a couple council members saw it. I got texts from a few of those council members like, hey, what's happening here? You know, can you identify who this person is? Are they media? And then after that, I heard like, hey, we're talking to the city manager about this. We're talking to the chief about this. And then the chief showed up within minutes to kind of, I think there were, you know, to see what was going on with the arrests, but also to see what was going on with this detention. And so it was a pretty quick reaction within, I'd say, 15 minutes.
And we have seen images of journalists being roughed up a little bit around the country. The Society of Professional Journalists issued a statement. SPJ asks police officers and protesters to let journalists do their jobs in covering the George Floyd protests. That's a reference to George Floyd, the man who was killed by police in Minneapolis. The society goes on to say, please do not target, intimidate, humiliate, or block our efforts from reporting the news during this historic time. Before taking any aggressive action toward us, take a moment, take a breath, and decide to do the right thing and let us do our jobs. I want to note another statement, this from Cincinnati FOP Lodge No. 69 President Daniel Hills, who says, quote, the police officers were 100% justified in their arrest of the Inquirer reporter. His aggressive approach towards resting officers was plain stupid. His identification was only a small card on a lanyard, and officers had no idea who he was. Police officers always have a right to be proactive, but especially at this time, we have been shot, assaulted, and continuously threatened. Dan Hills, the FOP president, goes on to say, Mayor Cranley tweeted the arrest was a big mistake and that the buck stops with me, and I sincerely apologize. The buck actually stops with our officers, Dan Hills wrote. Each day, risking it all, the big mistake was made by the reporter, and you made a bigger mistake by getting this wrong. Dan Hills goes on to say, you better apologize to your officers for this, Mr. Mayor. Their brave and selfless service has saved Cincinnati much of the pain and destruction seen elsewhere, while much of the media's coverage has been incendiary. Let's bring in Graydon attorney Jack Greiner. He joins us live on the phone as well. He has a specialty in media and the First Amendment. Jack, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jack, as an attorney in the field that you practice in, what are your initial thoughts about what FOP President Dan Hill said about the detention of an Inquirer reporter?
I understand that Officer Hills has a job to do and to stand up for his officers and the union members, but I think he's just wrong. I think if you watch the video, Pat's credentials were quite obvious. And if any one of the officers had just taken a moment to, take a breath and ask Pat what, he wanted, which was quite clear. If you look at the video, he's pointing over to where he wants to go to get with his colleagues he had been separated from. whole thing could have been avoided. So to say that somehow Pat was at fault or had it coming to him, it's just I'm just that makes me sad to hear him say that. I mean, I understand he has a job to do, but that's just not accurate.
What do you advise journalists to keep in mind while they're out covering something like this that is moving and shifting, and as police might change the boundaries of where people can go? What's important for journalists to know for their own safety, but also to be aware of their own rights?
Well, I think number one, and this sounds probably pretty basic, but I mean, you know, do your best to identify yourself as a member of the media. Certainly, we see people wear credentials around their neck. You know, I've noticed a lot of the TV reporters are wearing, you know, insignia kinds of stuff, Channel 5, polo shirts, that sort of thing. So I think the more obvious that you can make yourself, make it apparent that you're a member of the media. I think one reporter literally wrote press on a, you know, 8.5 by 11 piece paper and taped it to their shirt or whatever. But I do think that helps. But there have been 113 incidents of journalists either been arrested or targeted for some sort of violence over the course of the last week, many of whom are clearly identifiable. So that isn't clearly identifiable as media. So, you know, unfortunately, that isn't, you know, the end all and be all. I think, obviously, journalists need to respect lines where, you know, they're police set up, police tape or what have you, if it's an investigation. However, I think in this sort of situation, it's difficult because the lines move and change, and the crowd moves in different directions. So, you know, we tend to think about the police tape that there's a crime and the police set up a perimeter and, you know, journalists stay on the other side of that perimeter. In this situation, that, you know, frequently there isn't really a perimeter set up. There isn't really police tape that clearly denominates, you know, where a journalist can and cannot go. And the other thing that I've seen in some of the instances of arrests or, you know, abuse of journalists is that, you know, a police officer gives an order, but there's no really compelling reason for the order. And I really question even if it's lawful. There was a reporter who was arrested the other night who works for the Asbury Park Press, which is in New Jersey. He was videoing the police really, you know, beating up a protester, and the police told him, leave, you know, go home. And he's a member of the media. You know, I don't think that's a lawful order. He was in no way getting in the way of what the police were doing. He was merely documenting what was happening. And so I think it gets more complicated. I mean, I think, you know, but I think that journalists have been respectful of, you know, when they're asked to, you know, get out of the way. You know, maybe a car is coming or whatever. They're certainly doing that. I think Pat was doing that last night, quite honestly. I think he was just trying to explain that he needed to get to another spot. And I don't know, and, you know, I don't think I really accept the notion that the police have the authority to just, you know, arbitrarily close off where a journalist can go or what a journalist can film. So, you know, I think that all has to be taken into account. But I think this situation is, as I say, complicated and constantly evolving. I think journalists, you know, that I've seen used, you know, good common sense about, you know, staying out of the way of a police operation, staying on the perimeter. I know I watched a lot of, both Friday and Saturday night, you know, the TV news, and I felt that the TV reporters were very, you know, conscious of staying out of the way as much as possible while still being in a position to record what's happening, because that's the reason they're there. I mean, you know, we need the media there to let us know what's going on.
And we're talking with Jack Greiner. He is an attorney with Graydon who specializes in media and the First Amendment. And I want to ask specifically, Jack, as you talk a little bit about the media's role here and their rights and their responsibilities on the scenes of these protests, we started the show by announcing that the mayor and the police chief are issuing another curfew order for tonight. Is a curfew something that members of the press are expected to follow?
Now, typically, and I believe in the Cincinnati curfew order, I don't have it right in my fingertips, but media is deemed an essential service that's permitted to be out, you know, after the curfew. Again, for the very reason that they're there to record for the public benefit what's happening. And obviously, last night is a good example. People stayed on the streets after the curfew, and there was, you know, instances and incidents, and the media was there to record those. So in my experience, and this goes back to 2001 as well, the media is exempted out from curfew orders. If they weren't, there'd be, I think, a pretty strong constitutional argument that they need to be, but I think cities are, you know, realize the need for the media to have access to what's going on, so they tend to be exempted from curfew orders.
And we're also joined on the phone by Nick Swartzel, a City Beat reporter currently on furlough but still covering this story, and has done so prolifically over the past several days through his Twitter feed. Nick, are you out during curfew hours?
Yes, I feel like it's part of my job as a reporter for City Beat to document what happens to people who decide to protest after the curfew.
Is that when the bulk of the arrests are taking place?
Yes, it seems so. And as I said before, especially after the first night, most of the protests and marches are almost entirely peaceful. And as the city officials, as Mayor Cranley and Chief Isaac have noted, a lot of the things that happened on Friday night that were sort of beyond a peaceful protest happened late in the evening. So that's when a lot of the arrests are happening too, is after the curfew is over. And, you know, now they're happening to the peaceful protesters who are in violation of the curfew.
Do you, as a journalist, have an increased level of difficulty in dealing with some of the police presence out there in the curfew hours? So do they seem to be a little more attentive to your movements, for example?
Yeah, and I think one thing I want to say is that it very much depends on who the officer is. It's a very individual scenario. You know, the night before last night, I was with three Inquirer reporters where we were shoved away from an arrest that was happening. We were told we couldn't get anywhere near an arrest of about 100 people that was going on south of Finley Market. It is difficult. But at the same time, you know, like the first night the protest went on, this was before the curfew, protesters were out on the highway, and I was out there like covering it, and there was a police officer between me and the protesters who were crossing over a barrier on the highway doing something, you know, pretty dangerous. And I stopped for a second, like, oh, you know, is this guy going to check me? And he's like, if you're going to cover that, you should do it quick. So it depends on the officer. And yes, I have had some trouble the past couple of days with some officers.
In our last minute together, Jack Greiner, the attorney from Graydon, do you expect lawsuits to come from this from the perspective of any media outlets here or elsewhere?
I don't know about here. I don't expect that to happen, at least in terms of what has happened to date. I mean, I can't speak to what could happen going forward. I think in some of the other locales, possibly, as I said, there are 113 instances of, you know, improper arrest or violence against journalists. So we could see something emerge from any of those.
Jack Greiner is an attorney with Graydon, and Nick Swartzel is a furloughed reporter with City Beat. Nick, keep up the great work, and we look forward to when you're back full-time at City Beat. We can remove that furlough from your label. And Jack, thank you for the perspective as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
I want to go to our phone lines now and take a quick phone call. We have Ellie on the line. Hi, Ellie. You have a question or comment?
I do have a comment. Thank you for taking my call and letting my voice be heard. First of all, I am in full support of the journalism and the journalists to document, because I have a journalism degree and it's what we do, although I'm not currently using mine. One of the things that I found most disturbing about the policeman's comment is that he said the buck stops here. No, sir, the buck stops with the Constitution. And if perhaps somebody would take the time to read the Constitution, or perhaps go through a constitutional law book and read it case to case by case, and I mean going all the way back to Plessy versus Ferguson and Madison versus Marbury, perhaps you might have a better understanding of the Constitution and why I think the current administration, and I do mean presidential, is using it like people used to use Sears catalogs for toilet paper and outhouses.
Ellie, we appreciate the perspective and the phone call. Thank you so much for listening. I also want to read a statement that came in this morning from Archbishop Dennis Schnur of the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. He says, quote, "What is needed and what I am urging for each of us is a genuine conversion of heart, a conversion that will compel change and ultimately reform our institutions and society. As Catholics, we are called to radiate the love of Christ to all people and to be witnesses to his kingdom on earth. We need to look deep within ourselves in prayerful humility and ask our Lord to remove any vestige of prejudice or hatred from our hearts, any sinful inclination that keeps us from loving as he does." And there will be a prayer service called the Holy Hour for Conversion and Peace at 5:15 p.m. on Wednesday in front of the Cathedral of St. Peter in Chains in downtown Cincinnati. When we come back, we will be talking to a couple of people who spent many hours in jail after being taken into police custody during the protests in Cincinnati. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Metro just announced that they will suspend service today at 8 o'clock in accordance with the citywide curfew that was announced earlier this morning by Mayor John Cranley and Police Chief Elliot Isaac. So check Metro's website for check that schedule time, as no trips will operate after 8 p.m. And let's continue our coverage of the protest in Cincinnati now. We're joined on the phone by two individuals who say they were taken into custody and spent several hours outside in the Hamilton County Jail. Joining us on the phone is Danny Meeks. Danny, hello.
Hey, how are you doing today? Thanks for having me.
Doing well. Thank you for being with us. And we also have Katie Viox on the phone with us. Katie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Danny, take us to what happened. What led to your arrest or detention?
So we went downtown a little before curfew, because we had heard things were kind of getting a little wild down there. And Katie, on the other hand, you know, as a photographer, she said she wanted to go down and capture some of these moments, you know. So we went down there before curfew, and we were heading back kind of towards the car before curfew. And we kind of started getting blasted with, like, I got hit with a canister personally, and then we kind of heard in the distance, like, it sounded like gunfire, which I'm assuming is, like, rubber bullets being shot.
Wait, you were hit with a canister of what?
Gas, basically. Like, it hit me right in the hand, and kind of started to come out, and I kind of just took off.
Okay.
Like, the tear gas, so I didn't get affected by it.
Katie, let's talk to you as well. Did you see this happen? Did you see where the canister came from?
No. So when we were out, once we heard the sound, obviously everybody in the crowd kind of just rushed out of fear. And we were kind of on the go as things were moving and flying and happening.
Okay, so set the scene for us when you and Danny were taken into custody.
So as we were running, the cops pretty much ended up cornering a large group of us at Race and Green Street, I think, near Findlay Market. And they pretty much held us on all sides and had us kind of in the center. And one side of the officers actually said, they were like, you know, you guys can go home, like get out of here, you're after curfew, this is your only warning. But then we turned around and there was a wall of, you know, officers with their shields up saying, no, you can't, we're arresting you. And then we peacefully kind of protested back to them. We were all on our knee. We were just asking for peace. We were asking to go home. We were saying we wanted to go home. That was all we wanted. We would all leave peacefully. And they came up eventually and said, you know, if you cooperate, this will go fine for you, but you're all getting arrested. And they put us all in the plastic zip ties behind our back one by one and loaded us onto Metro buses.
Danny, after you were loaded onto Metro buses, where were you taken?
Down to the Justice Center where we waited kind of to go into intake.
How long did the intake take?
About an hour, and I was expecting to go inside, and we were loaded into, you know, like a concrete box on cement, which is where we stayed, where I personally stayed for 15 hours.
Okay, so you were inside the building, or were you outside the building?
No, I was outside the whole time. I never even went inside.
Okay, so set the scene for us, because we've heard from several people who were arrested or detained by police saying that they spent the entire 15 or so hours that they were in custody outside somewhere. Where exactly is outside in this context?
Behind like a barbed wire fence and behind like kind of two metal doors that open in the middle. What seemed to be like kind of a loading dock area.
Katie, I also understand from some people who had a similar experience to yours that the conditions were quite uncomfortable because their hands remained zip tied behind their back for all of this time, and there were no bathroom breaks, no water offered, no food. Is that correct?
Yes. So I was restrained outside from 10 p.m. until about 6 a.m. and that entire time I was zip tied. I did eventually find an officer who put me in cuffs because I was losing feeling in my shoulder from how long my arm was held back. But my wrists are definitely like deeply bruised from, you know, having cuffs on all night. And then we were never given water outside when I was outside once. We asked multiple times, but nobody was given anything. And then when I was brought inside, the conditions, I mean, we were body to body, not sanitized, no masks. Officers weren't wearing masks. So just completely ignoring that we're in the middle of a pandemic and putting all of us at a major health risk.
I understand that you saw someone have a seizure out there.
That was actually Danny. I was brought inside right before that happened. I was in like right inside of the door when I heard the yelling from everybody trying to get her help.
Danny, tell us what you saw.
I didn't see her actually fall, but I looked over and kind of jumped up to see what was going on. And she was face down on the cement. And I saw everyone kind of started rushing her, and officers were like, get back, get back, get back. We all started screaming out, like, you know, she needs a doctor, she needs to go to the hospital. And he flipped her over, and at that point, she was, like, totally unconscious, and her head kind of, like, was limp. And when he flipped her over, her head hit the cement. And we could tell she wasn't breathing, so the officer administered CPR and, like, luckily came back to, and they sat her down on a bench for a while. And then we eventually saw her brought into intake, and she went upstairs.
And then she was held with me a few times throughout the night after she was brought inside, but never taken to a hospital.
When you were brought inside, Katie, were you placed in a cell?
After the beginning part of processing, I was in a holding cell, but I was moved throughout multiple holding cells in the building. And eventually, after I had my health screen, I was moved up to an actual jail cell.
And how many people were in the cell with you?
The smallest cell I was in was a two-person cell, but I was stuck in cells with up to 15, 16 people. I mean, people were sitting on every accessible bench. People were standing. People were on the ground.
I heard from someone else who had been taken into custody the same night as you. And one thing he said was that this actually offered an opportunity to further create relationships with other people who share these particular values. And I'm curious if, in spite of the discomfort and any fear that you might have felt, whether you find that to be the case for you as well.
Definitely. I mean, we were all there to raise each other up. And there were even a few people who had other charges that had come in, not with the protesters. And we were all standing together and just trying to, you know, share our stories and talk about what had happened and just try to figure out what we can do moving forward to stop these injustices from happening to everyone.
Katie Vioxx and Danny Meeks, two people who were taken into custody during protests, sharing their stories with us today. Thanks to both of you for talking to us. We appreciate it.
Of course.
Oh, thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Joining us now are two very talented local writers who are kind enough to take some time to help us gain some perspective on this. Danny McLean, welcome back to the program, Danny.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And also on the line with us is Kathy Y. Wilson. Kathy, thank you so much for being back with us.
What up, what up? What's going on, Danny?
Hey, Kathy.
Hey, dear.
Kathy, since you're in good spirits in spite of it all, let's start with you. You've covered issues of race and other issues in general in our community for a long time. You have a very powerful voice here. What do you see happening right now as compared to other periods where these types of issues have sort of exploded over like this?
Well, it's deja vu all over again. This is 2001. In Cincinnati, it's 1968 all over the country. It's 1917 after World War One, and black men were being murdered. I don't know why white people were so angry at black people 103 years ago, but entire black communities were wiped out by organized mobs and white supremacists and armed white police forces. Black Wall Street was destroyed in Kansas. You know, other whole cities were, so it's the same. I think the level of racial fatigue has reached a frightening, not high, but low.
Well, help me understand what that means, racial fatigue.
Well, let me, I don't want to take up too much time because I really want to hear from Danny, but I'm not going to do a whole lot of over-explaining of cultural terms right now, because white people need to figure some of this out for yourselves. So if you are experiencing racial fatigue, you know what I'm talking about, and you don't have to be a certain race to feel that. So racial fatigue is like soul. You know when you have it, and when you don't, you can't really explain what it is.
All right.
Well, so I'll just say that about that.
Well, I appreciate that for sure. Well, yeah. Let's bring Danny in. Danny, from your perspective, what do you see happening right now in our community and across the country?
I think there are some things that are new, actually. I hear what Kathy's saying about deja vu all over again. And, you know, as someone who's been observing racial justice organizing and this kind of movement that's been broadly called Black Lives Matter for the past 7 years, there's something unique about this moment. And I just want to say, to make it clear, that I am not on the front lines at the protest. I am still practicing social distancing because of this global pandemic that we're in the midst of. So I'm speaking from being somebody who's, you know, observing what's going on, paying close attention to some of my favorite journalists who are on the front line, and also taking into consideration the context I have as someone who's been reporting on these issues for quite some time. What is new, I think that... one of the things that's new is the level of how gruesome the killing of George Floyd was, and the fact that it was, you know, a video of over 8 minutes of someone watching the life be squeezed out of them with an officer's knee on his neck. I think that in the wake of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, which was also caught on video, Breonna Taylor, who was killed in her home, a black woman in Louisville by police when they already had the suspect in custody. There's a black trans man who was killed, I believe, in the South in recent days. We've had this kind of rapid fire, you know, experience of black people being killed either by police or vigilantes. You have to remember it was just last week that Amy Cooper told a black bird watcher that she was going to call the police and say that a black man was threatening her life.
Right.
So we're kind of in the midst of this moment of like incredibly high tension when when this video of George Floyd being killed goes viral. I also think what's critical and slightly different about this moment is we are in the midst of a global pandemic. We have had over 100,000 deaths in the past, what, 8 weeks? A disproportionate number of them are black people. And that is in some ways related to who has not had the privilege of staying at home during the, you know, following these stay at home orders because they're essential workers. So you see black and Latinx people. You have and none of this has been acknowledged by the federal government. So we have a nation that's grieving. And that grief has not been acknowledged.
And so this is a bit of that boiling over, is that there's not been any type of designation to just mourn not just the racial injustice and the killings of these individuals, Minneapolis, Louisville, goodness knows, all over the place, but also the pandemic. Is that what you're saying, Danny?
It is. It is. And I think people are at their wit's end. People, we have the, you know, mass unemployment. Our economy is on the ropes. Capital is some, you know, I don't think it's going too far to say that capitalism is on the ropes. I think people are at wit's end. And one other thing I just want to mention about what I think is really different about this moment is black people are in the streets, right? But there are a lot of white and non-black people in the streets too.
Right
now, there are a lot of rumors and like it's unclear what's going on. I think it's fair to say that some of them are provocateurs and some of them are white supremacists, but many of them are people who are just like over it and who see, you know, what's happening, you know, police violence, state violence, not just as something that's happening to black people that they want to, you know, they feel so bad or whatever, but they also feel like they're worried about, you know, out of control police. And
now,
I've never seen that level before.
I saw a lot of that in 2001 when Stephen Roach shot Timothy Thomas. There were a lot of white folks on the front lines getting shot with rubber bullets, coming in from other areas, and some of them, like you said, Danny, weren't provocateurs. I don't think we saw too many white supremacists, you know, infiltrating the ranks or anything like that. But that movement fell apart because all the people involved had their own agendas and everybody wanted, you know, equal time and, you know, that whole thing. So it got sidetracked. But I am I've been overwhelmed with emotion seeing white people, not just in Cincinnati, across the country, standing up and taking knocks with all kinds of other people. And in my lifetime, I just turned 55. That's the first time I've seen that myself. And it's, you know, not been in history books or told to me by older people.
There is something apparently unique about the killing of Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis in the way that there's been so much response from traditionally conservative media pundits that, and this is somewhat anecdotal, I suppose, but on social media, you do see a lot of sudden criticism on these particular officers where you might not have seen that as openly during so many of these other high profile killings of black men at the hands of police, black women at the hands of police. And I wonder if there is some opportunity now that either people have seen this enough time to finally come to the conclusion that there is a very significant problem, and what ultimate impact that could have to not just have white people involved, but people who might be of a political persuasion that was somewhat hostile to Black Lives Matter's politics before.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gil Scott-Heron said that the first way to start a revolution is when you change your mind. So I think a lot of people are just changing their minds. Some things are just inhumane. They're just some things are just inhumane. That, and I think Danny can attest to the role of social media and just this unbelievable access to information now. And we're getting it on social media. So I don't read newspapers. I read New York Times headlines, but I haven't actually picked up a physical paper in forever. So I saw the other day this officer whose knee was in Mr. Floyd's back, that somebody had just unearthed his whole work history.
Right.
And all the times he had been in trouble and all of the use of excessive force during his police career. That's something that reporting in old school days, and certainly a daily newspaper, that would have taken some time, you know, to get your hands on the records, to, you know, look at them, to vet them and get it okay by an editor. I mean, stuff is just popping up and people have access to this information. So they are able to respond similarly very, very quickly.
We're talking now with local writers Kathy Wilson and Danny McLean. And Danny, one message that often emerges during national crises like this, when people want to be critical of maybe a government response or a particular section of the government's response, that we'll vote next time around and that'll change things. There appears to be some growing skepticism towards the idea that a vote will change the current situation. We certainly know that police killings have taken place for a long time across many different types of presidencies and governorships and mayoralties. Danny, what is the message this time if you see one emerging from activist groups as it relates to voting and whether there's another path that they see themselves forging instead?
One of the interesting messages that I've seen coming out of a group, it's really an umbrella of organizations called the Movement for Black Lives. They've been active for quite some time. They are really calling for people to think about divesting from police forces, meaning that pushing government on the local level to move resources away from their police departments toward other social resources, right? So there was an op-ed in the New York Times this weekend that was written by two people who are connected to the Movement for Black Lives, where they're saying, okay, well, if you think about things like domestic violence situations or when the police respond because someone's called the cops on a homeless person, there are a number of situations in which police show up when it's not a criminal or violent situation. So what would happen if we begin to look at budgets, local budgets, and move some of the money that goes toward buying police officers these like military grade equipment, and instead move some of those resources to other parts of the budget that fund social workers, that fund crisis intervention specialists, that kind of thing. Now that is a voting issue, right? Because you have to get people on the.
I've got 15 seconds.
Whatever that local body is, in order to move those kinds of policies. But yeah, voting, you know, just telling people to come out and vote in November. We just came through a very tumultuous Democratic primary season, and I think people are a little bit concerned about our options, given who the Democratic nominee is, and really what is going to be the
we're going to have to leave it there.
The Democratic Party to move policies and culture.
Danny McLean, Kathy Wilson, thank you both so much.